As CBS mentioned at the top of the hour, Oklahoma just passed the most restrictive abortion bill in the nation. And the last time we talked with Governor Inslee about this, he mentioned rumblings among Republicans here in Washington State to try to pass more stringent laws once the Supreme Court, if it does, overturns Roe v. Wade. I have not heard any specifics about those efforts in Washington, so I brought it up with the governor when we talked earlier this week.
Certainly. Of course we have. And I need to get you down Olympia more often, Dave. Look, the entire Republican Party is committed to taking away a woman's right of choice across the United States, in our state and all 49 other states. This is a plank of the national party. It is a plank of the state party. There have been 40 bills introduced in the state legislature in the last several years to restrict in one way or another a woman's right of choice. Their nominees for president have dedicated themselves to that, have now given us Supreme Court justices that are apparently will do so. Their candidates for major offices uniformly are against a woman's right of choice. There is no question that if the state of Washington Democratic system was turned over to the Republican Party, that you would see a reduction in women's rights of choice in the state of Washington. And I mention this because I actually had, you know, we had a press conference talking about this issue the other day, and one of the speakers said, well, you know, we're safe in the state of Washington here because we voted for this in 1970 or whenever it was. We had a popular initiative. We were the first state in the country to pass a protection of a woman's right of choice by popular initiative. But we're not safe because the moment you have a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, you will see, I think it's beyond doubt, restrictions on women's right of choice. And we've been lulled into a false sense of complacency around this issue of the state of Washington because of the Supreme Court decision. But once that protection is gone, and once the protection of the Democratic Party is gone from the women of the state of Washington, you betcha there will be restrictions. I think it is abundantly clear. Now, some of our Republican colleagues don't like to talk about that because they realize the vast majority of Washingtonians don't agree that you should put people, you know, women in jail for exercising their right of choice. But that's the simple reality.
So are you going to push a constitutional amendment?
I would certainly be supportive of it. I'd love to talk to legislative leadership to see if that's realistic. We will not be able to pass it because Republicans will all vote against it in the state legislature, or nearly all of them. And we need a supermajority to be able to get a constitutional amendment. So it's unlikely under the current situation we'd be able to pass it because it requires a supermajority in our legislature.
All right. Let's talk to commuters. We are seeing a bunch of construction projects underway. I understand that the expansion joints on I-5 south of Seattle, with which I've become all too familiar, are going to be fixed pretty soon. But are we seeing evidence of the federal infrastructure bill here?
Well, we will shortly, certainly, and there will be a significant investment in transportation. But I'd like to just for a moment celebrate what we've done in transportation. In the last several months, we passed the cleanest and the greenest transportation package in the state's history with just under $17 billion of improvements in transportation virtually on every part of our transportation system. It was a huge accomplishment. When we started the session, people said it was going to be impossible to get that done in a short session, but we got that done. And that means soup to nuts, new improvements in the transportation sector that we couldn't do if there was a gas tax holiday, but which will now give people more access to more lanes, more access to more buses, more access to light rail, more access to bike and sidewalks, and you name it, more access to ferry systems. It's just under $17 billion. And thankfully, it's being financed in part by $5 billion from our clean energy account that we implemented in the Climate Commitment Act to have the polluters pay for this so that they can make a contribution to these transportation improvements. So that's going to be as big or bigger than the federal component of our building plan for the state of Washington. And the reason we are doing this, and I always say when we build a bridge, and by the way, this will finance a bridge over the Columbia River over an I-5, which is, you know, something we've been working on for years, those are monuments to optimism. And we are optimistic about our state. We are growing. We are You know, we're growing because people are onto us. It's a great place to live. U.S. News and World Report said we were the best state to live in the United States. Oxfam said we were the best place to work during COVID. So we are a growing state. We ought to be optimistic about our future. And that means we need to make investments in transportation infrastructure. We're doing that big time in a very logical fashion. So I'm really happy about the progress we've made. And I know we'll make those expansion joints on your route our highest priority.
Well, I expect no less. What about things like the what about the ferry system? What about, you know, keeping I-5 in one piece? What about enforcing fares? Because can you have a viable transit system if people just get in the habit of not paying? And I think there's general agreement that the sound transit policy, as of right now anyway, makes it really easy just not to pay the fare.
Well, you know, I haven't delved deeply into that. This is a sound transit issue rather than a state issue, right? So I'm not passing the buck, but this is a different organization than mine. I do have some concerns what I've read about there, though. We're essentially not having an enforceable fare system. It seems to me that if you are going to have a fare system, you ought to expect people to abide by it. And from what I have read about it, I do have some concerns as to whether or not it's actually going to work. We ought to have some expectation that people pay fares that they're expected to pay, it seems to me. And if we do want to subsidize low-income people, we ought to find a way to subsidize them. In part, what we did in our transportation bill, which will give free transportation in our public system for those under the age 18, which I'm very excited about. So we found a way to actually help low-income people. You know, people under the age 18 are going to travel free. So we're doing that in a meaningful sense. I think we should. You mentioned the ferry system. Our ferry system has been vastly underfunded. We have had a huge need for boats. We don't have enough boats. And that's why I'm glad this transportation bill I talked about is funding new boats, including hybrid electric boats, where we don't have to breathe this polluting diesel smoke that we're going to bring on as fast as humanly possible. We also have some current challenges on staffing. The system has been chronically understaffed as well. So we are hiring people as rapidly as humanly possible. I just had a meeting about our team that is recruiting people to increase staffing so we can improve the reliability of the savings. But the transportation is going to do really important things for the ferry system. I'm very happy about it.
Governor Inslee, more with him next hour, including whether he anticipates a return to mask mandates. But Chris, so no relief in the gas tax. And is it your thinking that some of the programs that he's talking about, some of the energy programs, are actually going to add to the price of gas?
Well, most people who look at the carbon reduction package, part of the great the deal that they passed in the legislature, that Governor Inslee said, the polluters are going to pay. The polluters are going to pass that on to the consumers. Most people believe that we could see a gas tax increase of anywhere from 15 to 50 cents, maybe more, to pay for it. That's something that the Democrats will refuse to talk about because they say, oh, it's not our funding measure. It's a clean energy program. So there's some disingenuousness
there.
And
that comes in the form of a new tax, you're saying?
Well, yeah, it's the tax on the polluters.
Oh, on the polluters.
On the polluters, which sounds great. Make the people who pollute pay. The problem is, it's going to get passed to the consumer. Everything always gets passed to the consumer. And most analysts expect that this could see, a doubling, potentially, of the gas tax, which would kill the low-income people that it says that this project was supposed to help. So we'll see how it pans out. I mean, these are just estimates, so we'll see what happens.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
6:37, and our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, the influential Keep Washington Green campaign helped to prevent wildfires more than 80 years ago and has inspired similar efforts in dozens of other states. Morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, Memorial Day is next weekend, and that means camping season and the intense part of wildfire season are almost here. What better excuse to play this 1959 recording of seafood restaurateur and noted radio folk singer Ivor Hagland?
A fairer state than Washington no man has ever seen. Forests on the hills and vales do keep it evergreen. To keep it wearing of the green is everyone's desire. So everyone should work to stop the curse of forest fires. Put out that fire.
I'll play it one more time and we'll sing along with it.
Yeah.
So everybody knows Smokey Bear is the national mascot for wildfire prevention, but a few years before Smokey came on the scene, A group of timber industry people and Governor Clarence Martin right here in the Evergreen State launched Keep Washington Green in May 1940. Keep Washington Green was a publicity campaign to educate people about the dangers of forest fires and about what individuals could do to prevent them. It was a sensible idea, but relatively new back then to use the media not to sell a product but to alter public behavior. This was on the heels of a couple of big wildfires in Tillamook, Oregon in the 1930s. And with World War II looming, there was a thought we needed to protect the forest from sabotage or really any kind of fires. So Keep Washington Green had print ads, posters, songs like we heard, and road signs. And there was a junior forest warden program complete with membership cards. Oregon followed with its own program in 1941 and then Minnesota in 1944. And then there was a national Keep America Green program and lots of other state programs that also started up around the country. Now, we could go very deep on the story, and maybe someday we will, but I learned most of this from a guy named James Lewis. He's a historian at the Forest History Society in North Carolina. It's a library and archive that collects and preserves forest and conservation history. Now, I mentioned Keep Oregon Green and Keep Minnesota Green. Do you care to take a guess what our neighbors over in the Gem State did?
No.
Well, they called it Keep Idaho Green, but this is James Lewis of the Forest History Society describing their particular wrinkle.
Idaho goes a very different direction. They create a character from scratch. It's more or less like, looks like a cricket or grasshopper. And they take the word firebug and reverse the letters, and then it spells gooberif. And so their campaign was, don't be a gooberif. And you can still find one or two rest areas where as you're pulling in, you see words painted on the pavement and it says, don't be a gooberif.
Yeah. And never heard of this until yesterday when I had this conversation with Mr. Lewis there in North Carolina.
I would guess that didn't take off.
It actually did. It did. And there are still parts of Idaho where if you go nowhere to look, it still says in the pavement, don't be a gooberif. And the gooberif looks like sort of a hoodlum insect. He's smoking a pipe. He throws matches in the woods. It's the opposite of smoky, which sort of tells you what to do. This guy does what you're not supposed to. You're supposed to learn from his bad example, which is a little twisted, I guess. And it turns out, Washington wasn't the first place to use the Keep Green face. We actually stole it from Vermont, which had tried it in the 1920s, but it never really caught on. So it has a very checkered past. Again, we could do a very deep story on this. And the whole organization shut down in 1995 because they'd completed the job. Smokey Bear had taken over and the funding dried up. So all I can say really is don't be a gooberif. Yeah.
Well, I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Felix Spinell. All his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. I'll bet a lot of you can name some of the up-and-coming football stars from high schools around here, but would you know the names of the up-and-coming math scholars? I didn't think so. But maybe that's going to change. Here's Cairo News Radio's Nicole Jennings.
We all know about National Signing Day, when star athletes from a local high school sign to go play football or basketball at a prominent university. But we don't see similar hype for the honors students, the robotics club members, and the mathletes when they go off to school. That's why local political, business, and educational movers and shakers hosted their own signing event for this year's crop of STEM graduates. In a ceremony broadcast online, 49 STEM stars across Washington signed letters pledging to study at the colleges of their choosing next year.
Just like signing days for athletes, STEM signing day honorees will sign a letter of intent to pursue their STEM goals.
That's Sam Whiting with Boeing, which hosted this event here and in 15 other states. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. Each of the students will be pursuing one or more of these areas in their studies and careers. The students were each introduced by legislators and educational leaders from across the state. Democratic Senator Lisa Wellman of Mercer Island, who has a STEM background herself, presented several of the young scholars.
I have the honor to introduce and congratulate and recognize Emily Coe from Sammamish High School, who plans to study biomedical engineering at Washington University in St. Louis. Emily was inspired to study biomedical engineering when hearing a space biologist talking about their work during a NASA internship program. Congratulations, Emily.
The students will attend 2 or 4 year programs at schools here at home and across the nation. They're planning careers in everything from medicine to cybersecurity to air traffic control. But while it was a day of celebration, Renton School District Superintendent Damian Pattenaud also reminded the graduates,
with excellence comes achievement, and with achievement comes responsibility.
Pattenaud said it's less important exactly which college and which career they choose, and more important that they use their STEM gifts to make the world a better place.
While you may or may not return to your community, live and work, you must continue to turn your excellence into action in an attempt to improve the life of someone else.
At last, the moment came. The students got out their pens and signed their names to their future alma maters.
The 2022 Washington State STEM Signing Day honorees Please sign your certificate.
Nicole Jennings, Cairo News Radio.
So was this done online, Nicole?
Yeah, it was still done virtually because of the pandemic, unfortunately.
How'd they get that round of applause at the end?
It's the same kind of radio secrets that we use.
I see. Magic. I see. Okay. So at some point, I mean, what is the goal here? Is it to, for example, broadcast this on ESPN2 someday or what?
Yeah, next to the National Spelling Bee. The goal is just to get more recognition. I mean, I know when I was in high school, one of the first columns I wrote for my school newspaper was on this topic, that the scholars just don't get nearly as much recognition, at least on such a widespread scale, right, where we're hearing about it, you know, with the news reports. The scholars don't get that kind of recognition that the athletes get. I felt that. I mean, I was a proud nerd in high school. I can't catch a ball to save my life, but, you know, I got State Journalist of the Year. Where was my trophy next to the front office? Yet our football team, which didn't really win a lot of games at all, you know, every measly trophy they ever won was right there. So I think the idea is just to have some equality. You know, we should recognize all gifts and all talents. It's not to diminish sports at all, but just simply to lift the other kids up, because all sorts of talents are what we need in this world.
Absolutely, making the kids feel good. But what about those who think, gosh, this is the trophy for everyone generation?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. But I think the point is that these students really are. I mean, it's only 49 of them. It's not, you know, everyone who's ever taken a STEM class. Mm-hmm. So it really is the cream of the crop, and they deserve some recognition. I mean, they're going into some really impressive careers, and they are the future.
There should be a University of Washington draft day, don't you think, for
right?
the School of Computer Engineering? Where they just do it upright, and you're sitting there, you know, with your parents, and you jump up and down and clap your hands. And I never.
Yeah, Microsoft shows up, Amazon. I want this one. I want that one.
Right, and they put on a uniform, you know, based on which company drafts them.
Yeah.
There's the
lab
next step.
Lab coats.
Yes, right.
Oh, cute.
The ceremonial lab coat.
I like that.
Nicole Jennings. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk to Governor Inslee. And I think the number one issue on people's minds, Governor, is we're seeing rising infection numbers with the latest COVID strain. You still have your emergency powers, even though some in the legislature would like to limit them. So could there be another lockdown if this gets worse?
I think there's no contemplation of that. It would be quite unlikely. So I don't see that in the cards for us. We are experiencing an increase in both infections and to some degree hospitalizations. But I think there's every reason to believe that our success in making sure that our restaurants are open and our children are in school and we're going to our sports games, love the Seattle Storm game the other night, that success will continue. So I have every anticipation that success will continue, even though we are experiencing a variant that is apparently more infectious. But we now have learned with a combination of vaccines, boosters, more antivirals, people being responsible in their own personal lives, that we are keeping this in a situation where our hospitals can be sufficient to take care of our population. And that's really what we want to assure. So I feel good going forward, continuing the path we are on. And I think we'll continue to see some changes in our rules right now. We have some rules now that make sure that hospitals can, under my emergency order, we need it so that hospitals can continue to do their work they're doing and to protect employees so that, you know, you can't be punished for taking time off because of COVID. We need that emergency order to protect some of our employees, but mostly to protect the hospitals. But other than that, I think we're going to continue steady as she goes.
Okay, so it's fair to say you think another lockdown is highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. I think you'd have to see some new variant that would be significantly more lethal to occur. And, you know, hopefully that's not going to happen. And right now, I'm pleased that we have been able to get out of these lockdowns. We know how troublesome they were to us. And I'm glad we're in school. I'm glad we're in restaurants. I'm glad we're going about our lives. It's been a long couple of years.
Okay, so address the emergency powers thing. You were just saying that the reason for the emergency powers was to protect healthcare workers. What does that mean?
Well, there's some rules that we had to waive that required an emergency declaration. For instance, there's some rules about how you report some of your training for nurses that made it impossible to staff our nursing. There's some of these highly technical rules about when you deliver products that we had to waive so we could continue our hospitals to actually operate. And the emergency proclamation does protect people right now. Listen, if you get COVID and you have to quarantine today, we don't want you to get fired. We don't want you to get penalized. So my emergency order protects you from against an employee being punished for that. 14 states still have emergency orders. It depends on what the statutory system is in your state, but we need it because of some of these technical things. But listen, Dave, the thing we are going about our lives right now the way we'd like to. Like I said, we're working, we're going to school, we're going to the restaurant, we're going to games. We've got rid of, 95% of the things that affect people's lives. And I'm glad that we've been able to do that. We've had a relative success. And as you know, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, we have saved thousands of lives in our state because of some of the things we did together. And I want to give credit to Washingtonians who did act responsibly. If we'd had a death rate like Mississippi's, we would have lost another, 18,000 people.
But I hadn't heard before that you're saying without the emergency powers, if someone had to take time off for a COVID infection, they could be fired.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons we still have an emergency protection to protect employees like that. And and we've acted together as a state government. This is not just me making decisions. The legislature has confirmed a whole bunch of my emergency orders. They have not contravened a single one of them. They've had the opportunity to do that. So we've been in sync with the legislative branch, also with the judicial branch. The courts have now upheld our decisions 47 times in a row. So I think the state has been united in its democratic three branches of government, and we're having considerable success. Mm-hmm. We want to keep that up.
On a different issue, that being the price of gasoline. I just happened to fill up my tank, and it's a Prius, right? So it sips gas. It's getting 40.1 miles a gallon these days. It still cost me over $50, and the thing wasn't even completely empty, okay? It's true, I filled it up on Mercer Island, which has some of the most expensive gas in American history. But would it kill the state to provide a gas tax holiday, given that you have unexpected additional revenue?
Well, first off, let me, I wake up in the morning worrying about your Prius, Dave, so I want you to know I'm thinking about you. No, listen, seriously, this has been troublesome for people. There's no question, this rapid increase gas prices. I don't want to diminish what this does to people's pocketbook. It's a very legitimate concern. But what we've concluded is just putting more money into the gas company's pockets is not a solution to this problem, because that's what happens when you do like a gas tax holiday. A couple things happen. One, the gas companies just raise their prices to the point that they had it before. So the money goes to the gas company, to the oil company, rather than to the state. It doesn't actually reduce what you're paying at the pump. So all it really does is transfer the dollars that would be going into fixing our roads and bridges and just gives it to the profit column of the oil companies. That's what happened when you do a gas tax holiday, number one. We don't want to do that. We have a better plan, I think. We've passed a low-income tax credit to help low-income people, in part with some of their oil prices. It's an average of about $1,200 a year people will start receiving next year who are in lower income brackets that can cushion some of the shock of this oil problem. But you also have to realize, look, when you take money out, you stop doing things. I went to a new interchange program that was with bonded money. This money is, you bond against the stream of revenue. And if you stop the stream of revenue, you stop the project. So, you have these projects all over the state of Washington that would be delayed or stopped. And people want, less congestion as well. So there are some negative consequences. And I hope that the Ukraine war ends sooner rather than later. We can stop Vladimir Putin's madness that is in part responsible for this. And looking forward to the low-income tax credit getting implemented as well.
Go to Jay Inslee.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Victims of natural and man-made disasters often find themselves struggling to survive. That's why one Wisconsin woman is trying to help survivors rebuild their lives by repairing both the physical and mental wounds of loss.
For crafters like Ernestine Smith and Trish Henderson, the soul is fed with needle and thread. But the tools that made them so happy were lost after Hurricane Harvey.
Everybody had to get rid of everything, the machines, the fabric, the rulers.
That's when Margaret Jankowski turned up in Houston with 125 brand new machines.
And we gave them out in the parking lot of the center.
The Wisconsin woman started the Sewing Machine Project, which has now given out more than 3,600 new and used machines, helping survivors of disasters like Hurricane Katrina and refugees from Afghanistan and Somalia. Among recipients, a common thread. All are in need.
It made me be able to sew again.
It helps you economically and physically and mentally.
You got it down.
I got it down.
A tool that can provide income.
I made this on a machine that was donated.
For those starting over.
Why do you do it?
The fact that I can share them with people to whom they make such a difference is life-changing for them and life-changing for me.
A lover of the craft, helping others on the mend.
Oh, that's pretty.
That is Janet Shamlian reporting.
7:47, and here he is in full Seahawks garb. G. Scott from the GN Ursula
Show. Blue Friday, fam.
Yeah.
By the way, he pulled off an amazing baby shower yesterday for our morning news editor, Katrina Gashard, who's due soon, and Aaron Granillo, our afternoon anchor, who just had a little baby girl with his wife, you know, what was that, a couple months ago? Mm-hmm. Your friend provided barbecue. That was delicious.
Charles Davis, C. Ooh. Davis Barbecue, came through with so much food. No lie. I'm still full right now.
Yeah.
No, I ate it yesterday around 12:15. I did not eat the rest of the day, and right now I'm still full.
Delicious stuff. And it was so nice to finally get together as a group and celebrate as coworkers. I think that's the first time we've done that since the whole pandemic started.
We got some great coworkers inside of the building.
We do.
So do you want to talk about how this name, image, and likeness thing has changed college recruiting? Or has it changed it? It just brought out what was going on all the time.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So here's what happened yesterday. Two head coaches that make nearly $10 million a year were going back and forth at each other because of name, image, likeness. Just so you guys know, the average head coach, Power 5 head coach in 2000, was making $400,000. The average Power 5 head coach today makes $5.75 million. But a lot of times people say, but the name, image, likeness is the problem in college football. But let's get to it.
Okay.
So Nick Saban, who is the head coach for Alabama, he first went after Deion Sanders, Hall of Fame football player, who's now the head coach of Jackson State. He went after him in his conference by saying that he alleged that Jackson State paid top recruit Travis Hunter $1 million to go to Jackson State.
Whoa.
So he brought that up. Then he accused Texas A&M of essentially buying their players with public money with NIL. Now, I have
what's
to
NIL?
Name, image, likeness.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got it.
Then the head coach for Texas A&M, who's Jimbo Fisher, who got a $95 million contract.
$95 million?
Yeah. I just wanted to, champagne problems, y'all. Champagne problems.
What?
Anyways, Jimbo Fisher calls a press conference right away, and he says, I did not take Nick Saban's call, because Nick Saban tried to call him like, hey, man, you know. No, I'm not taking that call. I'm taking this public. I'm going on air. You know how people try to say stuff publicly and then privately try to make it cool? Mm-hmm. I know some folks like that. He wasn't playing it. Then he goes to the press conference and he says, quote, some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out about this guy and a lot of things you don't want to know. We build him up to be this czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody's whoever coached with him. You can find out anything you want to find out, what it does and how he does. Now, just to give you some history, Jimbo Fisher used to be an assistant under Nick Saban. Bottom line is this. Champagne problems, yes. But Nick Saban doing this was one of those, like, there's usually honor amongst thieves in college football. and Nick Saban crossed the line.
So what's the beef? Are they just fighting over college recruits and they're throwing money at it?
Well, the beef is Nick Saban is having a problem because other teams now are doing what he used
to
do.
What he's always done.
What he's always done. And so ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun. Mm. So again, Jimbo Fisher used to work under Nick Saban, which is why I don't understand why Nick Saban would do this.
Yeah.
When you get into the college football world, you find out things. You learn things.
Yeah.
You see a lot of things. And these are the reasons why I don't, when people try to, well, isn't a college education enough for these sports kids? This is why I'm not going back and forth with you. And then, oh, well, my school, no, we don't pay players. Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of paying that goes on. Just because you're not winning, you know what I mean? Maybe you're paying and you're not winning. That's a problem.
Right.
So you have there's a lot of money that's in college football.
So is all this unfolding the way it was expected, or are people now thinking twice about having opened this can of worms?
Well, you shouldn't think twice because college football is an awful, awful way that it has been continuing to be done. Let me say what I just said again. The average football salary in the year 2000, I didn't even go to the 90s or the 80s. Mm-hmm. The year 2000 was $400,000 a year. Today is $5.75 million. That doesn't even include the broadcast. That doesn't include all of the TV
money.
So
you're saying this shouldn't be college at all? It should be like a farm system? Just turn it professional?
That's all it is. Oh, well, these kids, they go there for their education. Really? Really? No, they're going there to play football.
Nobody believes that.
Nobody they do.
It's like a bonus if the football players also really. But yeah, I don't blame the kids who have a skill, and it's like a vocational skill, right? You're not going to make a kid go get a 4-year degree at the University of Washington if they want a vocational career and they can do it, at an apprenticeship. Same with football players in college.
You got to use college football the best you can with leverage. It's not always about making it to the pros. You can actually go in there and use it. For an example, if you look up Champs right now, go to Champs, the place that you buy shoes and athletic apparel. You go look on the cover of Champs. Right now, you'll see G. Scott Jr. right there
really?
On the cover.
Whoa. Oh my gosh, I want to go see it.
You must be proud.
Champs?
Absolutely. Champs, champs.com. Yeah. Go look. He's right there on the front.
Oh my goodness.
So that's what I'm saying. You got to use college football for what it is.
Yeah.
That's all you do.
What I learned today is ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun.
Already.
Yep.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Starting on Monday, new Seattle police recruits will be going through a brand new kind of training before they even get to the academy. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. So this is all kind of this ongoing effort by the Seattle Police Department to reform itself, learning from a lot of the missteps and some things that happened going back to the George Floyd protests in 2020. The Inspector General's office has come out with their Sentinel Review, kind of the deep dive into several different days of those protests. And then earlier this week, we had the crowd management psychology report that came out. So all of this stems from that. And earlier this week, we told you about the public order engagement, or the POET team, which is focused on relationship building with protest groups on the front end to create a line of communication. But there's more than that changing at SPD.
For me, as a chief, I really focused on trying to build a level of compassion and empathy in the department. And so POET is one component of kind of this relational policing initiative. Right now, we'll be launching the SPD Before the Badge, bringing our recruits in 45 days prior to the academy, and really instilling social emotional learning and brain development and giving them the skills to be able to have their focus on their own wellness.
Chief Diaz says, on top of that, this new pre-academy training will also help with community relationship building.
Be able to create listening sessions and opportunities to have dialogue with communities that have had a level of mistrust. And that right there, developing those listening sessions and opportunities to have those conversations will translate into a situation where they can be used in a POET situation because they've had those difficult conversations prior to ever being involved in some sort of protest or situations that could result in some level of rioting.
And Chief Diaz says for SPD,
this is all just part of just how our department wants to operate its level of service. And I think sometimes you don't know what you don't know until you're made aware of it. And I think the Sentinel review process has really made us aware of a lot of things that we can figure out ways to improve and do better.
Now, a big goal of that POET team and now this new training is to give SPD officers the social, emotional, and communication tools that they need when we talk protests, though there are always going to be a handful of bad actors in the crowd.
They're wanting that confrontation, but we got to make sure that we don't create that confrontation. And if we're able to develop that dialogue, develop that empathy for what the person is experiencing in situation, the emotional component of it, and being able to direct that level of empathy into a positive manner for them to have the ability to be successful, they'll weed out those bad actors in the crowd. That helps us being able to just pinpoint the problem rather than focus on the whole group and address the whole group trying to manage the crowd. People learning about the history of different demographic communities, so the Native community, the Latino community, the Black community, and it really creates an opportunity for people to understand, like, when you're policing a community, you have to know some of that history to understand, like, we have not always been on the right side, so how do we make sure that the way we police takes that compassionate, empathetic approach?
So it sounds like the police department is taking responsibility for what went wrong.
Largely. I mean, for so long when we were in those 2020 protests, the conversation was quick, you know, was defund the police and a reimagining of policing, right? Mm-hmm. So this is that. This is part of that discussion. This is after that Sentinel review and these deep dives into what happened, and especially the interactions with the crowds, right? How the SPD were so quick to indiscriminately using those weapons against the entire crowds, often of thousands, when there was maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 bad actors mixed in the crowd. So that's one of those big changes they want to make, is learn how to have that communication on the front end so that they can make sure that they can get those bad actors out. And the organizers of the protest will most likely help you. They'll be pointing them out because they don't want them there either. Mm-hmm. But if each side makes the assumption that the other as a whole is acting in bad faith, then that's how you see it get escalated like it did, right? So in order to do that, to have that mentality, you've got to go and train all of your officers to understand each of the communities that they're going to work with, right? So 2020 protests, we're talking about the Black community and how they feel about policing and how they feel they've been treated unfairly and people have died unfairly, that kind of thing. You've got to go in with that mentality of understanding that as a cop, right? So that's what this new training is about.
Okay, so how do you expect this to play out? And again, for people who don't know, you were there at those original demonstrations, so I mean, you're right in the middle of it all. The other side also has its tactics. There are groups, those bad actors, as you call them, who are intent on creating mayhem. So let's assume we're in a demonstration and that group of people dressed in black says, okay, this is go time. What's the new scenario for how that's handled?
So the new scenario was going to be the work of that POET team, which is, again, is just kind of coming up now, but they've got a dozen or so, I think up to 15 of those folks trained. Some of them are the community service officers who are unarmed officers, and their job is to, when we have a protest or some big event, get to know the folks in charge right away, have an ongoing communication line with them. And then, so for instance, if we're in the Pink Umbrella Day, right, which I can remember very clearly, there was just a handful of bad actors, but the organizers were consistently hollering at them, saying, please, we don't want this. We just want to march past the East Precinct, right? So the idea there would be that you've got you've got some of those officers inside that crowd. There's been that community relationship build up already with the organizers. So they communicate together as those bad actors act badly.
So some members of the crowd
get them out together.
Some members of the crowd would direct the cops to the bad people, and the cops would drag them off. And you're saying nobody would protest, saying let them go, let them go. They're just protesting.
The idea is, and I think I could say that this would have worked on that Pink Umbrella Day. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you know those cops are just going to get those bad actors, the ones that are trying to turn this into chaos. Mm-hmm. And all the big number of people want to do is do what they had intended, which was to march, right? They don't want those people disrupting this protest any more than the cops do. So, and they yeah. have that line of communication. They have a certain amount of somewhat of trust already built. So that's the idea there. We'll have to see it in practice. I have seen a change. I was out at that Roe v. Wade protest last weekend, and there was a kind of a clash between the two sides going on. And I was very impressed with what I saw of the Seattle police officers who were lined up in the middle of that. And how, I don't know if cautious or careful is the right word. It was clear to me that they were using a different mindset than when I was in that very same spot 2 years ago.
Car News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.